thank you very much for the introduction. What I want to do today is to say a few words about my new book project called The Fabric of Space, and to pick out some of the themes which I've been working on as part of that project. As Kevin said, my interests span across different aspects of urban and environmental research, and also cultural and historical dimensions as well. So, in today's lecture then, I'm going to be talking about water from a variety of different vantage points. I want to start with a quote from the French philosopher Gaston Bachelard, which for me seems to be superficially self-evident, and yet is highly problematic. And it seems that this sense of drawing on nature as some kind of a primordial or ahistorical essence for the framing of environmental discourse is extremely widespread. And I was very intrigued. To look at some of the feminist critiques of the work of Gaston Bachelard, among other critical perspectives. And it seems to me straight away that if we are to deal with the question of water and its relationship to modernity and urban culture, we need to unravel the wider context within which water interacts with human societies and move away from some of these essentialist tropes which are so prevalent in environmental discourse. Now, in terms of thinking through the relationship between water and human societies, there are perhaps two main focal points that I've been particularly interested in. One is that of infrastructure, which is quite a topical field of research. And what's interesting to me about infrastructure as a topic is that although it originates within actually French engineering discourse in the late 19th century in relation to railway construction, nevertheless, in the 20th century, the word infrastructure has become very closely associated with various technological networks that enable the provision or control of water. So there is this close intersection then between water, infrastructure, and technoscience. Now, in preparing the introduction for my book, I watched a film that made quite an impact on me, Elia Kazan's Wild River from 1960, which is a film about a young engineer from the Tennessee Valley Authority who tries to improve flood defences. But in going to some of these isolated rural communities under threat, he really comes up against a whole gamut of political and social issues. And underlying this film from 1960 is the sense that the engineering of water is fundamental to modernity. And the engineering of the river also involves tackling racial prejudice, unequal wages for white and black workers, extremely impoverished and isolated communities who might now be connected to electricity, better communications infrastructure, and so on. So the film for me then is a microcosm of the politics of modernity and water infrastructure in North America, presented, I think, in an extremely interesting way. So from the outset then, infrastructure is far more than mere technical networks. It's fundamental to how society actually understands or views itself. It intersects with so many spheres of social and political change and contestation. The other, if you like, broad thematic focus that's been particularly fascinating to me for a number of years is that of landscape. And here again, if we look at the etymology of the English word landscape, it's very closely related to particularly Dutch words, earlier words used in the 17th century in relation to water engineering in the landscape, the transformation of the landscape. And in its early origins then, the idea of landscape was very much about controlling and transforming facets of nature. And if we look actually at some of the early examples of landscape art, such as Meinert Hobbema, the Avenue at Middelharnis, 1689, It's not only a very important representation of landscape at a time when the genre of landscape art was emerging, but it's also a representation of a transformed space, and a kind of, if you like, a proto-modernity in relation to techno-science in terms of this drained landscape, as well as the extremely sophisticated use of perspective and so on. So landscape then, the idea of landscape, the origins of the term landscape, is closely associated with water and modified landscapes, including flood control and agriculture and other fields. And what's interesting, however, about the term landscape is that through the 20th century, it's moved away somewhat from this earlier, more utilitarian usage to encompass a wider variety of vantage points or perspectives in terms of the aesthetic experience of space, and in particular more distanciated modes of engagement with space, and in particular a dominance in terms of the visual perception and experience of space. And something that's interested me in some of my other work recently is moving beyond visual tropes of landscape interpretation and looking at the, for example, acoustic spaces and also olfactory environments as well, and thinking about the senses in relation to modernity and urban space. So what I want to do today then is to look at four themes in a bit more detail with you. Axes of visibility, different ways in which space has been perceived. Secondly, questions of periodicities and metabolisms, thinking through how we might make sense of historical change in relation to water and urban space. Thirdly, I want to bring in some questions surrounding the relationship between the body and technology under the theme tactics, tubs and technologies. And then finally, under representations, I want to look at some possibilities for using art and literature, for example, to explore some of these interrelationships. So, under this theme then of axes of visibility, I would start by saying that conventional histories of public health and history of urban space tend to suggest that there was a fairly straightforward relationship between proving the origins of disease and then acting to transform urban space. However, there has been a variety of extremely important historical scholarship. Richard Evans, for example, in relation to Hamburg, Frank Snowden in relation to Naples and other scholars, who've really shown that this was an immense struggle to actually transform the physical space in response to particular threats posed by inadequate urban infrastructure and the threat of disease within 19th century cities. Many decades after, if you like, the science or engineering had been better understood, there were still arguments about how these new systems might be designed, implemented, and in particular paid for. So I want to really begin then by suggesting that the history of urban infrastructure is contested and checkered and has many false turns, delays, or problematic episodes within it. If we think, however, about ways of analysing this relationship between cities and urban infrastructure, one of the interesting recent fields of work has been what you might call urban political ecology, and attempts to trace the interrelationship between political economy, the flow of capital, and the flow of water, or the construction of urban infrastructure. So scholars like Eric Swingerdal, for example, and also naturally Maria Kaika, Alex Loftus and others have worked very intensively on these questions. And this just intrigues me as an engineer's map of West Berlin in the 1960s, and the sheer complexity of these hidden infrastructures beneath the streets of a city. Now, more recently, these questions around urban political ecology can, I think, be extended in some interesting ways. For example, in relation to the embodied experience of technological networks, different conceptions of agency, including non-human agency, the micro-components of urban space, questions of scale, I think, are interesting. And also, I think there's a need, perhaps, to engage more with the biophysical sciences And I want to now explain one particular avenue where I think urban political ecology and the biophysical sciences could come together closer in a very productive way. And this is the field of urban epidemiology. And one of the consequences of the foreclosure crisis in North America has been the proliferation of abandoned swimming pools. And within these abandoned swimming pools, various vectors of disease, particularly mosquitoes, have bred. And there's now quite a lot of research suggesting that there's been a spread of encephalitis across parts of North America, which is related to this changing urban topography as a result of the foreclosure crisis. Now, these kind of relationships might surprise us in the context of North America, but of course in the global South, the sense of a relationship between urban epidemiology and urban topographies would be much more familiar to us. So that the spread of dengue fever, for example, in the global south, very much related to urban topographies, abandoned building sites, rubbish, even the plastic bottles, the plastic tops from Coke bottles have enough water in them potentially to allow insect vectors from disease to breed. So this sense then of the interrelationship between water and urban epidemiology, I think, is a really interesting field to explore in more detail, as it relates, of course, to the political economy of space as well as the physical characteristics of space. Now, I mentioned a second ago that possibly one of the characteristics of cities in the global north is this sense that infrastructures are to a significant degree hidden or invisible in some sense from the gaze. Now, as we look at the cities of the global south and what Arjun Upadhyay, the anthropologist, terms horizontal cities, much of this infrastructure is paradoxically, because there's a shortage of infrastructure, nevertheless, paradoxically, it's much more visible. So if we look at a city such as Lagos in Nigeria, where I've done research previously, one of the characteristic features of the city is that there are buckets everywhere in order to retain or store water. So I would think a city of buckets would be quite an appropriate epithet for this kind of city within which there's an extreme shortage of infrastructure and access to potable water. So we have then a very clear, if you like, topographic contrast between the plumbed cities, if you like, that we associate most closely with modernity in the global north, and cities within which the introduction and construction of infrastructure has been much more staggered or in certain respects incomplete in terms of standardised models of what a modern city should actually have. Now, this horizontal vertical axis has other components as well, historically. So if we look at mid-19th century Paris, and I'm sorry, it's not particularly distinct, this image here, but in fact, the poor typically were clustered in the upper stories of apartment blocks, because in the pre-elevator age, there was considerable inconvenience to be living furthest from the street, and also furthest from adequate supplies of water and so on. So we have this, if you like, a vertical segregation of the social classes within the mid-19th century city. By the end of the 19th century, however, in Paris and other industrialising cities, this vertical social segregation begins to become more of a horizontal segregation with the emergence of new working class neighbourhoods and so on, particularly clustered in what was then the outer part of the city, but of course now we consider to be the inner city in terms of these 19th century fast-growing cities. These vertical separations by class, however, have not simply disappeared. Interesting research by Danny Dorling at Oxford University shows that in many high-rise apartments, you get a similar kind of clustering of people on lower income towards the upper floors, particularly of more badly maintained social housing projects and so on. So there's something of that vertical separation has not disappeared and it still exists. So I want to move on now to the related question of the historical phases that we might try to identify in relation to these changes. Now, The use of ideal types for analysis, I think, can serve as quite useful heuristic devices. If we think of ideas such as the modern infrastructural ideal introduced by Stephen Graham and Simon Marvin, the bacteriological city I've occasionally used in some of my own writings. Nevertheless, I think we need to be quite cautious in terms of using these ideal types as explanatory models because of not only global variations between global north and global south, but also variations within the global north as well. So, for example, if we think about post-war Europe, if you looked at, I just have a couple of quick examples here, that in Morley outside Leeds in the late 50s, half of the homes lacked a bath, and almost a third shared a toilet, whilst in the Gorbals district of Glasgow, also in the late 50s, only one house in 30 had a bath. And in parts of the former West Berlin, such as this is Kreuzberg in the late 1970s, there were even more extreme differences in terms of access to plumbing and what we might consider to be the modern bathroom. So I guess really the point I'm trying to make here is that although we think in terms of these ideal types and the spread of a particular model of the modern city, even up until comparatively recently, many cities in Europe or the global north also did not have this, if you like, standard notion of a fully plumbed city, each household having access to a private bathroom and so on. So these processes were much more slow and uneven than we might readily recognise. I also want to suggest that the notion of an ideal type is highly problematic when we look at specific examples from the global south. And I want to just quickly mention one of the case studies that I have used in my book, and that is malaria control in the 1940s in Lagos in Nigeria. Now, I mentioned a few minutes ago this question of urban epidemiology. Another very significant threat for cities through history has been malaria. And in the case of Lagos, the main threat came from mangrove swamps around the city where the insect vectors bred in very large numbers and caused very significant ill health within the metropolitan area. Now, the interesting thing that I found looking into this is that the very rapid program of malaria control introduced in the 1940s was not on the pretext of public health, though the threats are well known, but it was for geopolitical reasons, because the main Allied staging post during the Second World War for North Africa was at the airport of Apapa, opposite Lagos Island, and it turned out that something like 80 to 90% of military personnel were quickly becoming ill on their way to North Africa. So it then became a kind of geopolitical priority to drain these swamps around the city of Lagos. But this period of swamp drainage and malaria control in the run-up to Nigerian independence in 1960 also reveals a whole host of interesting anomalies and developments. So the figure on the right here, who was one of the key malariologists working in Nigeria, Leonard Bruce Tratt, he actually, after Nigerian independence, he became one of the leading figures within the World Health Organization, continuing with work in malariology. And what struck me, which was interesting about this phase of malaria control, is that the colonial state, or key elements of the colonial state, morphed into a new kind of post-colonial state apparatus, including the World Health Organization. Furthermore, a lot of the medical and particularly scientific assumptions about the control of malaria through the 1950s and 1960s proved to be inadequate. And in the contemporary context, malaria has become an even greater threat within the city for a combination of reasons, particularly ramshackle housing, lack of access to primary medical care, and a proliferation of breeding sites because of abandoned building sites, open sewer networks, and so on. So what was seen momentarily as something that could be solved, particularly through the application of a fairly simple set of ideas, hooked, if you like, to the utopian movement towards a post-colonial state for Nigeria, nevertheless proved extremely complicated in practice. And this forms one of the case studies that I develop in the book. So this whole question then of what kind of models we can use and how far we can apply them is of particular interest to me. Another historical facet, if you like, to this debate concerns urban metabolism. Now, here again, this very much has to do with how urban space is conceived, particularly in the eyes of architects and engineers. Now, William Harvey's original diagram, when he discovered how blood flowed through the body, proved to have an architectonic influence in terms of conceptualizing urban space. And the notion of the city as a kind of body or organic machine that could be intervened in or controlled or modified at will has been very influential in terms of engineering discourse. This is the cover of Scientific American from September 1965 with this famous article by Abel Wolman, The Metabolism of Cities, which really conceived of cities as a sophisticated machine that, if you like, a cadre of technical experts could intervene in or control at will. So possibly you could argue that in the 1960s we had the high watermark with this, if you like, techno-euphoria or techno-optimism in relation to the city, but also relates to my earlier comments about epidemiology as well. So we have then this movement towards an almost complete faith in the possibilities of techno-modernity and scientific politics. And this notion of the city as machine has also inspired, art that's on the boundary of architecture. So Fritz Kahn, the famous representation, Man as Industrial Palace from 1926, in a way extended some of these technical notions to the human body itself and was also part of a wider hygienist discourse that developed in the early decades of the 20th century. But there was some sense here of a utopian vision centred around science and technology and its application to urban space. Now, in terms of actual physical structures, probably dams represent some of the most striking examples of physical features of infrastructure to emerge from this phase of technical discourse. This is the Garrison Dam here from North Dakota, completed in 1956. And there are many other examples that we could choose to look at. The political scientist Timothy Mitchell has written in a very interesting way about the Aswan Dam in Egypt, and particularly about the unintended consequences of these huge infrastructure projects. The way in which nature itself, he actually also talks about the threat of malaria, the way in which the agency of nature exceeded the intentions of hydrologists and water engineers. But thinking about these vast projects like the Garrison Dam, I think takes us back to a question if we're to do research on cities, and that is, what is the city? Where does the city end? And in this respect, I think it's quite useful to go back to some of the earlier work, for example, of Henri Lefebvre and the Urban Revolution, and his contrast between the city as a defined physical entity and urbanization as a much broader set of social, economic, and also technological processes. So adopting an expanded conception of what the city is, we could, for example, consider that most of the UK is effectively urbanised, which we know, but even more radically, that it really forms part of one huge kind of urban space. And one of the themes that has been investigated in relation to this, if you like, this Lefebvrean reprise in urban theory has been the exploration of those landscapes that are related to urbanisation, so-called operational landscapes, or for example, mining, unconventional hydrocarbon extraction, fracking, for example, is very much, we could very much see that as a kind of urban frontier, not dissimilar to some of the huge water infrastructure and dams and technological networks involved with providing water for cities. So energy, food, and other basic needs for cities also engender their very particular or distinctive landscapes as well. And in relation to water, I've mentioned a couple of times this kind of techno-euphoria or the possibility of a technological fix. One of the interesting themes to watch, I think, will be desalination technologies and the possibilities for nuclear-powered desalination plants, which are now under discussion. So that, I think, will be a very interesting, if you like, new frontier in terms of the techno-politics of water in coming decades. So I want to move on now to the kind of third strand, that of tactics, tubs, and technologies, and reflect a bit more on the relationship between the body and the city. Now, there's been a range of work which I found very interesting, which has sought to rethink the relationship between the body and the city. There's the Foucauldian-inspired work of the historian Patrick Joyce, The Rule of Freedom, also the German sociologist Elisabeth Heidenreich, Fließräume, about the spaces between that are actually produced by infrastructure and the relationship between the body and infrastructure. And a range of studies has really begun to explore what you could consider to be the co-evolutionary dynamics of bodily conduct or human behaviour and technological networks. But this notion of the relationship between the body and water within the urban space has a very long and very rich and complex history. So if we consider the engraving by Albrecht Dürer at the Women's Bath from 1496, this is a kind of snapshot of a vanishing medieval world. What's interesting about this a drawing from Albrecht Dürer is that at the time in which he made his studies, in fact, communal bathing was declining, partly as a consequence of the bubonic plague and a nervousness or fear of communal spaces. So what we see here really is a vanishing history of another age captured in the work of Dürer. And as we move through into the 17th and 18th centuries, we have a rather curious situation of declining water use for washing for a combination of reasons. And in fact, if you look at textbooks from that era, there was actually a fear of water. People advised against washing too much, that water might soften the skin or make people more susceptible to illness, and a whole range of different perspectives that we would find very curious indeed. And that cleanliness was very much about visibility and appearance. It was really the face and hands that should be clean. And there was a whole set of interesting discourses surrounding water, the body, and a fascination also with white linen or clean clothing was seen as symbolically extremely important during this period. But gradually, however, with the growth of cities and urbanisation, these earlier ideas gradually fell into decline, and the role of water was revisited in the context of better physiological knowledge, improvements in medical science that dispelled some of these earlier misconceptions. There were also new attitudes towards dirt as well, and a newfound, if you like, revulsion towards some of the sort of dirt and dirty places within fast-growing cities. And of course, the growing impact of disease as well began to play a role in shifting some of these earlier discourses about contact with water and the role of water within urban space. The bath, which is a kind of focal point for a number of interesting studies about water technology and modernity, the bath itself begins to become more frequent from the 1860s onwards. We could talk about a return of the bath, but very much a private bath rather than a communal bath. However, before the wide availability of hot water, clearly the bath was not a particularly popular to domestic fixture. And if we look at some of the backgrounds of the emergence of the modern bathroom, in fact, by the late 19th century, hotel architecture was particularly significant, and we gradually see the emergence of what we might regard as the modern compact bathroom, or the typical kind of plumbed bathroom space. But again, I would emphasise that this process was rather slow and uncertain, And you only have to look at histories of toilet technologies to see the dozens of many, frankly, absurd designs that existed before something edged towards a modern design of a toilet for a modern plumbed building. So we have then, gradually, in terms of cities and urban space, we have a kind of water revolution that trickles through urban space with these new technologies, which begin to affect human behaviour in many different ways. We see the rise of a greater corporeal self-consciousness that the historian Alain Colban describes in great detail. We see a new biopolitics of the body and increasing attempts to encourage the greater use of water and washing, with all sorts of complicated implications for the flow of water through urban space that gathers momentum. So as we edge then towards a semblance of what we might recognise to be the modern city in hydrological terms, there are many different simultaneous processes underway. And certainly through the 20th century, there's a much greater emphasis on utilitarian architecture and utilitarian aspects to the interaction between architecture and engineering within the modern city. And among the very interesting examples we can point to are the Thames Barrier, completed in 1982, which, to my mind, is an extraordinary example of utilitarian engineering architecture constructed in response to a very specific threat, the threat of flooding. And the fact that it took about 30 years from the original flood incident in 1953 to the final completion of this engineering structure, it also points to the complexity and long time period behind many of these most radical and far-reaching infrastructure changes within the modern city. And I'm sorry this diagram is a bit difficult to see here, but there was a conference held in 1977 about the design of the Thames Barrier, which had a whole series of extraordinarily intricate diagrams about the mechanisms and design. And an Italian architecture magazine did a whole spread of these designs from a purely aesthetic point of view to accompany a text about the importance of the structure itself, because it was in itself such an impressive and in some respects a revolutionary engineering achievement. But, of course, hidden behind this, if you like, engineering architectural facade are other complex stories. The cover of this book here was to celebrate the former Greater London Council's municipal architecture, replaced with the much weaker Greater London Authority in the year 2000. So behind then these structures is a very interesting and complex debate about the relationship between these engineering structures and the public arena and the kind of political discourse that lies behind infrastructure on behalf of some putative public good. In this sense, the protection of London from flooding. Now, one of the themes that I've really taken out of the research that I've been doing on water and urban infrastructure is the sense that there are many possible pathways in terms of the intersection between politics and technology. And in this respect, I've been particularly influenced by the American philosopher Andrew Feinberg, who writes very extensively on technology. And he writes about the many paths of rationalisation. And he's particularly interested in how we connect between technological change and political and democratic change. And there's just one small example I wanted to quickly share with you, which I thought was interesting. And that's the case of Berlin, which had its water system privatised shortly after reunification in 1990, and then recently brought back into public ownership as a result of a grassroots campaign within the city. And there are many interesting facets to this debate. But I think one of the important lessons from this whole question is that there isn't a necessary teleological path towards one particular model for technology and its relationship between cities. And one of the most complicated things that the activists confronted was the need to make information public that's contractual information related to the original arrangements with the private company, as well as a range of technical information about the water supply system, have been kept secret. So fundamental to their political campaign was making information public to actually instill some kind of a political debate about technology in the urban arena. So certainly in Berlin and a number of other German cities then, extremely interesting debates around this whole question of taking back the city and taking back essential public services, energy as well, back into public ownership. There was actually, just recently, there was a referendum on taking over the energy supply system for Berlin, which was very narrowly lost in the city for a combination of complex reasons. But nevertheless, there was this very intense debate then about municipal services going on in a number of European cities, which I think is extremely interesting in terms of the wider context of technological politics. Now, thinking about water and the shift away from the kind of techno-managerial model, whether a statist or, if you like, a privatized version, this movement away from a techno-managerial model towards new possibilities opens up all kinds of interesting questions in relation to scale, for example, whether the individual household has a different kind of relationship with water, water use within the home, the differentiation of different sources of water for different uses, rainwater harvesting and so on. Of course, none of these questions would be strange to many households in the global south who already differentiate very carefully between very limited supplies of water. But nevertheless, there are these interesting questions developing. Also, in terms of the question of scale, radical approaches to the protection of watersheds for cities. New York City stands out. A very, very intricate and elaborate process of negotiation to protect the sources of water supply for the city so that it wouldn't have to introduce very expensive filtration technologies for its water supply. The point, again, I think, is that there are potential alternatives in terms of the relationship between technology, space, water, and urban society. Now, one of the questions which, of course, looms in all of this is how climate change will affect the relationship between water and cities, and in particular, the threat of flooding. This is an image from Rain and Marshes, just on the eastern boundary of London. And one of the big questions over the next few decades is very likely to be this tension between adaptation and resilience, whether, in the case of London, for example, whether there would be a movement towards a major new defensive structure, much bigger than the Thames Barrier that I just briefly mentioned, or some kind of an accommodation with water, and certain landscapes, it would be understood, would act in themselves as periodic flood barriers. Posing all kinds of interesting questions from a planning perspective, for example, because the Thames Gateway is one of the most ambitious zones of redevelopment in Europe, and there are tens of thousands of new properties that have been built in areas at risk of flooding, and that's a very complex and interesting debate. That in fact it was insurance companies, as well as ecologists, incidentally, and other interest groups who had warned against some of these radical development proposals to the east of London. So we have these tensions then concerning the landscape, water and the landscape, in relation to future development. There have been some attempts to develop slightly different strategies, which I found extremely interesting. This is Ladywell Fields in Lewisham in South London. And in this particular case, a tributary of the River Thames was re-meandered through a public park, a rather desolate and underused public park, to create a kind of semi-natural water feature, but also a spillway to help with the possibilities of flooding within that part of London that's quite susceptible to flooding. And very interesting discussion surrounding this project, because certainly there were anxieties among homeowners that a traditional concrete defence would have been safer than some kind of engineered water landscape such as this. But nevertheless, it's attracted a lot of attention.
ecologically as well, when I was actually taking this photograph, there was a flurry of excitement because a little egret, a rare water bird from Africa, had landed in a tree attracted by the water feature in the park. So from an ecological point of view, these features have unexpected results as well. Another related question, I think, to rethinking the relationship between water and cities. This is a section of the Los Angeles River, where there's been, over the last 10 to 15 years, there's been a lot of emphasis on trying to take sections of the river back, if you like, from being a purely kind of concrete drainage system into some kind of an ecological landscape. But here there are some significant tensions that we find. When I interviewed somebody in relation to this landscape here, he pointed at the vegetation here and suggested that it was a struggle between good and evil, between a native Californian species and invasive species growing, without irony at all. And it really struck me that this notion of the creation of an ecological landscape or ecological restoration is laced with very complex ideological tensions in terms of what is a natural landscape, what kind of urban ecology is appropriate for a metropolitan region such as Los Angeles, and certainly a kind of a cosmopolitan ecology was not what some of these environmental activists had in mind. Furthermore, as these new landscape features have emerged along the Los Angeles River, there's been a flurry of new developments springing up, sort of waterside developments, expensive apartments. So we have an interrelated dynamic of ecological restoration and what you might call ecological gentrification going hand in hand in this metropolitan region. Okay, so I'm coming on now to my final theme I wanted to talk about, and that of representations. One of the points that I would like to really make today is the possibility, if we're going to do interdisciplinary research, to think about a broad range of sources that we might find helpful, if only to spur the research imagination. And if we're thinking about transformations of urban landscapes, I think art and literature can be immensely helpful. So this painting here from Gustav Caillebotte, who is better known for his paintings of a Second Empire Paris and the newly modernized boulevards, at about the same time, he was also depicting the edge of the city. And I find this particular painting very intriguing because he had this a tributary of the Seine that basically is a semi-natural landscape, a place of evident tranquility, possibly a place of relaxation, but also a space that's being sucked in to the rapid pace of 19th century industrialization in the Paris metropolitan area. So it's a landscape in transition at that particular moment on the edge of the city, and it also speaks to the role of water in urban culture as well, in urban landscape, I think, that particular painting. Another painting that really caught my attention is Adolf Menzel's depiction of a rear courtyard, clearly a painting from the window of his study, and you see here a communal water pump with heavily trampled ground around it, and then on the horizon, the advance of the city itself, sort of rapid rate of urbanization. But this kind of incidental or interstitial landscape, this little, this almost sort of nondescript, unimportant scene, nevertheless, to our eyes, can be extremely interesting and useful in trying to think through what these spaces might have looked like and what kind of intersections existed between water infrastructure and urban landscape at this time. In novels, we also find wonderful explorations of water within the modern city. In Zola's L'Assommoir, there's a description of a communal laundry way before the modern washing machines and so on were in widespread use. And it's this
terrifying place, the main character enters this hall with this kind of deafening roar of shouting, steam. It's a very, almost a very intimidating place to enter this communal laundry in this working class neighbourhood of Paris. But we get this extremely vivid sense of everyday life and its interaction with water. Also fascinating to me is in James Joyce's Ulysses, which describes, which was framed around one day in early 20th century Dublin. There's this extraordinary description of water, which some of you may be familiar with, which is basically when Leopold Bloom pours some water to make a cup of tea in the kettle. He goes into this sort of reverie about every possible aspect of water. He reflects on how it got there from the Roundwood Reservoir in County Wicklow, and he thinks about its democratic equality and constancy, and also the noxiousness of its effluvia in lacustrine marshes. And he kind of covers every conceivable facet of the relationship between water and modernity in this sudden reflection. But he also wonders about his friend Stephen Daedalus, the hydrophobic friend who hadn't taken a bath in many months. So it's a kind of interesting insight then into this transitional moment. Water also features in terms of more experimental literature and science fiction literature. And I really should, of course, mention J.G. Ballard, the British science fiction novelist, who had this particular fascination with the abandoned swimming pool as some kind of, if you like, rupture in terms of modernity, some kind of fascinating space that recurs in his writings. And I have a nice photograph here of the Uxbridge Lido in London, lying in a state of disrepair. But for J.G. Ballard, then, the abandoned swimming pool was variously served as the exposed anatomy of modernity, variously imagined as places of violence with easily clean tiles, psychic zero stations, or entire landscapes of drained concrete pits like votive offerings. So we have this very imaginative reaction to ruins in the urban landscape. But Ballard, of course, has been criticised for his heavily dystopian take on the relationship between technology and society. And I just want to show you a contrast, which is what I would call a counter-dystopian vision. This is from the Squint Opera as a digital collective, called Suburban Bucolia, on an oak, which is a suburb of South London, imagined in the year 2090. And there's a whole series of these images that they produced. But fundamentally, everyone seems quite happy and cheerful in these images. They've accommodated very well to this flood of London where nature has taken over again. There's another image of the interior of St. Paul's Cathedral, full of water, with somebody about to dive off the Whispering Gallery, which is at the highest diving point into the interior of the building. But it's a kind of counter. I like these images because they unsettle the notion that science fiction representations are always necessarily a gloomy or dystopian in relation to imagining the future. I sense that my time is beginning to run down a little, so I'm nearly there. I wanted to share with you some examples of photography in relation to water as well. The photographs of Benton Hiller Becker, which will be familiar to many of you, record industrial architecture, industrial infrastructure in a systematic way. Their work starting in the 1960s and then, for the most part, completed in the late 80s. And what's very interesting about, for example, the Water Towers series, dozens and dozens of these beautiful large format photographs, that they're presented as a kind of typology, like maybe microorganisms, diatoms or plankton, in terms of the similarity and yet subtle differences between them. So there's a kind of typological approach. It's not certain whether these structures are even in use or not. And they're also, to some extent, they're relics of a Fordist
industrial landscape, landscapes of mass production. And their work has been in Pennsylvania, Italy, Belgium, Germany. They've chosen these industrial landscapes and they've recorded them for posterity with an extremely interesting body of photographic work. But I think it links back with this question of the relationship between water infrastructure and water architecture and what these structures actually mean in the context of modernity. I'm also struck by the work of Jane and Louise Wilson, who did a series of photographs taken inside this vast structure, the Hoover Dam, these strange deserted corridors that seem to sort of curve into infinity. So again, a very interesting set of responses, if you like, to the mystery of these infrastructure installations, those installations upon which we're dependent. And what they're like aesthetically if we actually experience these infrastructures directly. Another influential example, Edward Butynsky with his water series. So we have an aerial photograph here taken on the edge of Phoenix, Arizona. I actually originally thought that I would use this image for my book. And I contacted the studio, and really the two reasons why I didn't use it. One is it would be very, very expensive to use it, and the second reason is I got this strange email suggesting that the title was now different. And I won't read it out to you, but basically it's a much more exact description of the Indian reservation, Native American reservation, lying directly to the left of this line. And what immediately struck me was that when he took these pictures, he was uninterested in the processes on the ground that had actually created these landscapes, that he was purely interested in the aesthetics of these landscapes. So the fact that he felt it necessary to correct the title in a slightly odd way made me feel that the work did not really speak to the kind of arguments that I was trying to develop anyway in the context of the book. And also that the emphasis, if you like, on the aestheticization of water infrastructure or water landscapes ran somewhat counter to the kind of argument that I was trying to develop. So, to conclude then, what I've really tried to do through this research is pull together a number of strands that I've been working on. And because I've taken an interdisciplinary approach, I've also been very interested about in how these different bodies of literature, how these different ideas actually speak to each other, and some of the quite formidable barriers to developing coherent analytical frameworks that can include art, literature, film, engineering, science, ecology, hydrology, in different fields, and all of the different facets, if you like, of what constitutes the relationship between water, modernity, and urban space, and to try to bring these together into some kind of analytical or explanatory framework is quite a formidable challenge. And it may be that I've only been partially successful, but I feel that it's really necessary to think through the implications of these different bodies of work to build a richer explanation for some of these processes that I've been looking at. And I'm also struck by the way that technology itself is often quite weakly developed within some of the most influential philosophical frameworks that we use, particularly within the social sciences. So for example, Jürgen Habermas, who of course is extremely influential in terms of arguments around communicative rationality and so on, has really rather little to say about technology. Equally, Richard Rorty, who really has a brilliant critique of foundationalism and his attempt to present science essentially as a series of metaphorical redescriptions. Nonetheless, he's very wary about how, if you like, the private realm of the imagination that can be connected with the public culture of science and technology. It's a kind of problematic relationship. His inclination, in a way, is to keep the private, the individual, and the creative separate
from the public realm as we would understand it. And I think that's problematic. I think we need to be able to combine imaginative insights with a way of evaluating rival explanations for material reality, material change. So thank you very much. I'll leave it there.